for the week of July 3rd, 2016. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 327, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And on the streets of New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
And Michael, you literally mean you are on the streets of New York. I thought it was because it was the 4th of July weekend here in the United States and you were out at a barbecue celebrating with fireworks, but no, you're literally out on the streets.
That's right. I'm covering the homeless situation here in New York. And I want to tell you, no, I'm just visiting New York City. I'm down south for the summer. And this is where I can set up to do my show.
That's right. Yeah, Monday was a holiday, which is when we normally record. And due to travel schedules and work schedules and schedules in general, you're literally out on the streets. So if
that's right. And I have a question for you.
Yes. What is
that? Why is the FBI covering up for Crooked Hillary? So call us at 1-800-FOX-NEWS and let us know what you think. Oh, I'm sorry. Wait, I'm confused. This is the entertainment podcast, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's not.
I do all these other podcasts. I don't know if you know that, but that's a different one that I do. It's called I'm Right, You're Wrong. And there's the knitting podcast. But this is Showbiz Sandbox. I'm sorry. Okay, I'm focused now. Okay, let's go. So what are we going to talk about on this week's entertainment podcast?
On this week's show, we'll riff on music. The Jay-Z digital music service Tidal is being put into play and Apple might take a bite. I guess, yeah, I really shouldn't try the comedy. It's the latest proof that streaming digital music is a very hard business to make work. On the bright side, people are consuming more media than ever. During Inside Baseball, we're celebrating diversity. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences made headlines by inviting a record number of people to join, including a record high number of women, people of color, and international artists. But as they themselves point out, this amounts to a drop in the bucket, or as I like to call it, about 10% of the bucket. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We pull our information from ComScore. You can find them online. We have a link in our notes. We also look at box office profit, box office mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is Finding Dory. It made about $85 million over the weekend and in North America on Monday. So we're including figures from North America that include Monday. We also have information from the rest of the world that is Friday through Sunday.
And apparently the New York City Police Department does not like the fact that Finding Dory is still in first place after 3 weeks.
That's right. So basically, this is the money we know it's made so far. Just to clarify what numbers we're dealing with, some of it's apples versus oranges. It's made $85 million in the last few days. It's at $550 million worldwide, half a billion. And I think it's certain to get to $1 billion. Looking at some of the records it has, it's about to pass Captain America and be Disney's top grossing movie in North America so far this year. And it's almost certain to pass Shrek 2 and become the all-time highest-grossing animated film in North America. That means Disney will have 4 or possibly 5 movies that they have released in 2016 that will gross at least $1 billion. That's amazing. But that's what's happening now. Of all the movies that have grossed $1 billion in history, there's 26. 23 of them have been released since 2000. And when you look at the whole chart of the top 100 grossing movies of all time, only 9 of them came out before 2000. So that chart is changing dramatically. It's not just about adjusting for inflation either, because there's such a bigger worldwide market available that, yes, there would be some classic films like Gone with the Wind and Sound of Music on there. But this chart is and will be, by every measure, dominated by new movies because they can play all around the world.
Now, do you think anybody would say we're kind of really stretching here or calling it before the game is over? Because right now we're at $540 million worldwide for Finding Dory. That's halfway there. That's 50% of the way there. I mean, that's a long way to go.
Well, yes, but we've seen the hold. It's made $50 million in its third weekend. It only dropped by about 30%. It's at $380 million in North America. It may hit $500 million in North America alone. So knowing that, knowing how it's doing overseas, knowing that it's playing in 41 markets, which means there's a lot of markets that hasn't opened up in yet, we can say very confidently that this movie is going to gross $1 billion. We don't know the fate of The Legend of Tarzan, however. That grossed $64 million over the weekend. It did better than they said, which means the audience liked it better than the critics. It cost $180 million to make. It's in 20 territories. This looks like it will probably be a wash worldwide, and that's how the tracking was on the 1st of July. And now that we're on Tuesday, we know, you know what, the expectations were low because it wasn't tracking well, and it did a little better. So word of mouth was okay. So it's certainly not a roaring success. It's not the launch of a new franchise, but financially, worldwide, we'll have to wait and see where it ends up, but it could be worse. At number three around the world is Independence Day Resurgence, another $60 million. This is at $250 million worldwide. And number four is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Out of the Shell, $31 million worldwide. It's at $180 million and counting. At number five, the big success story of the week after Finding Dory is The Purge, Election Year. $35 million over the 5 days that it's been open. I say five because it's a four-day holiday weekend, but it opened on Thursday, as we know. So for 5 days, it's made about $7 million a day, a great opening for The Purge. That includes some overseas territories, but most of that is almost virtually all of it is in North America. Just 100,000 or more came from overseas, so I'm not sure where else it's playing. But this is a great success story. It cost $10 million to make. Like Saw, it's a horror porn sort of franchise that's very violent, but it's got a clever hook. Audiences are turning out. The reviews were good. And when they want to say this is the year where audiences are turning off to sequels, no. Finding Dory, The Purge, Star Wars Come Christmas Time. There's plenty of films that are sequels that are making money.
Well, and a little known fact, actually, it's very well known. James DeMonaco wrote and directed this film, and he's an old colleague of mine who, along with Gary Nadeau, wrote Jack with Robin Williams, directed by Francis Coppola.
Why would you bring that up on a happy day? He's having a good week. Why would you bring up Jack?
Oh, well, you know, hey, at the time it was a pretty big
launch
to his career. Well, okay.
It was a flop. Why are you mentioning a flop the week he has a big hit film? And then his grandmother might say, why can't you write something nice like Jack? This Purge, it seems ugly.
Well, he's written and directed all of them.
I'm sure he has. And why can't you write something nice, as his grandmother might say? I like Jack.
Well, he also wrote The Negotiator. He also wrote The Negotiator.
He's having a fine career. And now he's turning into a director and he's got a franchise. And number six around the world, is this a franchise? Central Intelligence with Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart. Or Kevin Hart and Dwayne Johnson, depending on your point of view. $30 million over the weekend. And number seven, Now You See Me 2, one of the many sequels that isn't working. But since every movie is a sequel, you could say that about almost anything. It made $24 million over the weekend. It's at $215 million worldwide. And then here's the big story of the week. It's the BFG.
Wait, I thought Purge was the big story of the week.
Well, the big flop story. The big positive story is Finding Dory and The Purge, Election Year. The big negative story is Steven Spielberg's The BFG, which opened to $26 million worldwide. Not a good launch for Spielberg, not good reviews, not good numbers. What does this mean?
Well, first off, it's only in three territories, okay? So it still has some major territories to go, such as China, I believe. And so I think, yeah, I did not see this movie doing well, having seen it. Not that it's a horrible movie. It isn't a horrible movie. It just doesn't work at least.
Good. Nobody likes it. It's not getting good reviews. I mean, don't be ashamed to say it's a movie people aren't enjoying, for God's sake. A bad movie.
I mean,
if it was a good movie, critics would like it or audiences would like it. Neither does, at least in North America.
Correct. I would say at least in North America, because certainly look, and I know we hate to go by the Rotten Tomatoes, but look, 71%.
Well, you shouldn't. But if you look at the actual reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, even of the 71% that gave it a it doesn't suck review, very few of them were saying a modern classic. Does this mean Spielberg is washed up? Headlines immediately. You have to, of course, go crazy to get any attention online. People said Spielberg's done. His magic touch is over. It's all over. He's dead to the world. He doesn't have it anymore. How stupid is that?
Yeah, I think this just didn't... It's a film that wound up just not working.
Right, it's a bad movie, but if you look at Spielberg in recent years, he isn't trying to make big blockbuster world-spanning movies. He's making Bridge of Spies. He's making Lincoln. He's making War Horse. And by and large, he's making movies that make money. So he's adjusting his budget and adjusting what he's achieving and attempting to the material that he wants to do and to the money that he's spending. So this isn't a guy who's spending $200 million to make Lincoln. He's spending a modest amount of money, or $200 million to make Bridge of Spies. So he has the touch. He's obviously beyond the years where he can turn out one big blockbuster classic after another. But, you know, the last time he tried to make a big blockbuster, it was I think it was Tintin, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, I thought Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of Skulls, that made a ton of money. But after that came Tintin, which was quite a flop. But there you go. You know, he's hardly washed up because of one movie that doesn't do well. Any director who's made, you know, 30 movies is going to have a flop here and there. At number nine around the world is Ice Age Collision Course. This opened up in seven territories, but not North America. It has a good start at $20 million. And number 10 is The Conjuring 2, another sequel that's hugely successful. Don't believe people when they say sequels aren't working. Just sequels that don't work, don't work. It made $18 million over the weekend, $275 million worldwide. Now we finally get to a movie that is not Hollywood-centric. It is Bounty Hunters. This is a Chinese, Hong Kong, South Korean movie. It's an action film. It's got comedy. It's sexy. It made $16 million on its opening weekend. And I will jump down to also include No One's Life is Easy. This is at number 15 on the worldwide charts. It's called No One's Life is Easy, So I Married an Anti-Fan. Or that's the alternate title. This is a Chinese-South Korean movie, or it might even be a pure South Korean play. I was a little confused because the lead actress is Chinese and the lead actor is South Korean. And the language is both. And I'm like, what's going on here? Turns out it's based on a manhwa, which is a South Korean manga, essentially. That's their term for graphic novels. And it's about a female entertainment reporter who has to cover this male pop Korean star. And, of course, she's fired for some reason. She hates him. She becomes an anti-fan, which I've never heard of, but I know exactly what it means. You're probably an anti-fan of Justin Bieber, for example. And then,
Or my humor. Yeah.
Then, of course, she falls in love with him, and then they get married. We're seeing more and more of this. You look at Bounty Hunters, and you look at No One's Life is Easy, and a lot of other movies. You're not just seeing Chinese films set in South Korea, some other territory, or Korean films that include a Chinese star, but actual co-productions between two of the biggest markets in Asia for creating great movies or successful movies that, you know, can dominate the Asian market. So that crossover, I mean, we've seen China and Hong Kong, of course, but now you're seeing China and South Korea. That's pretty interesting. At number 12 is Me Before You, the romantic drama about dying teenagers, or young adults, I should say, $13 million over the weekend, $135 million worldwide.
$136 million. I would say that that movie is doing quite well.
Absolutely. And there's a sequel book, so there may very well be a sequel film.
Okay.
So Finding Dory does have some competition coming up. It's The Secret Life of Pets from Universal. That's been open overseas in a few territories. It made another $12 million. It's at 13th. It's at $30 million and counting. And number 14.
I can tell you that, like, all the kids, at least around me, they cannot wait to see this movie.
It's a good trailer. And next, there is The Shallows, the Blake Lively action film, another $10 million. That's at $36 million and counting. Given its budget, that's a big success story. And at number 16, as far as I can tell, it's Camping 3, which I think is a French comedy about a gay man, I think he's gay, who spends his summer at a campsite and hijinks ensue. It made $8.5 million over the weekend. It's the third in this series, and I'm pretty sure it didn't cost $8 million to make, so that's probably a success story as well, as is true for Ab Fab, the movie. That's based on, of course, the long-running British sitcom. That opened up in the UK, and it made $5 million. I know friends who are really looking forward to seeing that in the US, and the reviews were pretty friendly.
You know, I think I like this whole you being outside thing because it makes you talk so fast so that, you know, you can get in everything before, like, the next police car
comes by.
Exactly. I love it. I our listeners will probably like it, too, because, you know,
I doubt it. I talk too fast as it is.
Well, you know, what's not going fast is the merger between AMC Cinemas here in the U.S. and Carmike Cinemas. This was a $1.1 billion merger, and it looks like it might be in a little bit of jeopardy, as I mentioned on Celluloid Junkie this past week.
Why is it falling apart?
Well, some of these shareholders at Carmike are saying, look, you know, AMC, you offered $30 per share. That's too low. Even though our stock was trading down at around 22, 23, 24, you know, it should be $40 per share. That's the offer that we would accept. And it looks like those shareholders who own about 18% of the stock are getting more and more shareholders on board who might actually, over at Carmike, kind of nix this deal. And AMC is saying, look, we're not getting into this whole, like, loose price thing, okay? We're not going to start giving you more money. We're not. This isn't a negotiation. That was the offer. If you like it, great. If not, we'll be just fine. Will you?
be okay? Or do they feel like they're in a good position, or because they're in play, are they now not as stable? Do they need a partner?
You mean Carmike?
Yeah.
Well, Carmike has been looking to sell itself for some time. They were in talks with AMC previously, earlier in 2015, and then those fell apart, AMC kind of went away. AMC is looking to expand and expand rapidly. As the shareholders over at Carmike point out, if you don't purchase Carmike and it's 2,500 screens to add to your circuit of, some like 6,000 screens, then you will have to buy the next six circuits combined, the next six cinema chains combined, to reach the same number of screens and become the number one.
Well, could that be cheaper than buying Carmike at $40 a share?
It could be, but it's not just about how much money it costs. Remember, there's a lot at play here, including where are those theaters, what venues and multiplexes will AMC have to divest of due to antitrust regulations or anti-competition regulations. It's easier to do one deal than it is to do six.
So when will it wind up? When will we know what's going to happen? Probably within a week, within a month?
July 15th is when the shareholder vote is now scheduled to be held.
All right. So would you buy some cinema chains in China? Because I hear their box office is it slowing down, or what's happening there?
I don't know. I guess last year box office grew by 50%, but of course you can only grow so quickly so fast. And in the first 6 months of this year, it looks like that growth has slowed to 20%.
So it's growing, just not as fast.
Correct. As you would expect, by the way. That's every market, whether it's an economic market for a new product or a new product itself. That is what happens. Look at iPhone sales, although that's actually probably a bad example.
So now the idea that China might pass North America as the number one box office within a year is perhaps a little too optimistic.
I always thought it was relatively optimistic. I thought certainly, look, you're talking about
a
country with... Yeah, it's 1.4 billion people, okay? Even if you say that, 50% of them cannot afford a movie ticket, which is not true, that's still 500 million people. Yeah. That's still like 600 million people that can go buy a movie ticket. When you have, you're talking about what, in the U.S., it's what, 325 million people, not all of whom can afford a movie ticket? I mean, start doing some math,
And
it's pretty simple to see that bigger countries will have bigger box offices.
And yet India is nowhere near.
Correct.
Do we know what the total box office in India is?
No, although now that is a very, very good question. I'm going to look that up. I'm sure I could find it relatively quickly, maybe not during the show, though.
So the Chinese box office is growing, but not as fast. But what may disturb them a little bit more, or maybe a good sign for Hollywood, is that the first 6 months of the year have been dominated a lot by Hollywood movies.
Yes.
Is that a positive sign, or will China say, uh-oh, we don't like this?
Well, they're always saying, we don't like this if somebody from outside China is doing well. Just ask Apple. Disney.
But it's companies in China that are distributing them. It's Chinese theaters making money. It's Chinese people buying popcorn. And, so it's not strictly money going all the way completely. Hollywood only gets 20% of it, right?
Correct.
So
yeah,
that's
roughly.
A lot of money in China that they're making.
That's true, yes. But again, they're very concerned about, cultural mindshare. So they don't like soft power when it's soft power in their country. They like soft power when it is their culture being exported.
Which is why I must watch The Mermaid.
Okay, I'm not quite sure where that comes from. But
it just
sure.
came out on Blu-ray. It's the number one film of all time in China, and it's supposed to be funny.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's okay.
They want me to consume their media.
Much like, if you look at, I dropped my kids off at summer camp today, okay? If you look at Disney Pixar, their soft power, they're exporting that from the U.S. into China, as we mentioned in weeks previous with the opening of Disney Shanghai. On Thursday this week at my kids' summer camp, it's Disney/Pixar day. Your campers can show off their favorite Disney Pixar pizzazz by dressing up as one of their favorite Disney Pixar characters. We're going to try and say Disney Pixar one more time in this sentence.
What horrible camp have you taken your children to?
Actually, it's a great camp called Galileo. It's all about science, and they build robots, and this week they're building a go-kart.
Why would they have a Disney Pixar day? That's ridiculous.
Because some of the kids are really, really young, so it's really more for them.
Even if you said dress up as your favorite character, why would you limit it to Disney Pixar?
I have no idea, that's but I just ridiculous. Thought it was is I thought it was interesting that it was that
that's
they are actually
and branded. I mean, did they pay for that? That's
no,
just something they did.
Not.
That's horrible. How creatively stifling. I think you should complain.
I'm gonna complaining. It's on my list of today. Hold on, let me just make a note. Complain to summer camp about. So should I also say, you know, Looney Tunes and
how about and, whoever they want? Dress up costume day. Dress up as whoever.
What? How about dress up as a summer camper day?
Yeah. So your kids are consuming Disney Pixar propaganda at their summer camp, but that's pretty par for the course in North America, isn't it? Media, media, media.
Yes, and we're not talking about news organizations. We're talking about TV shows and music and movies and DVDs and Blu-ray. You name it. Here in North America, we're consuming it.
I assume that's TV, web, radio, computer, and all that stuff.
Yeah, and maybe even podcasts, although I will tell you, if you're listening to Showbiz Sandbox, we're like free calories. We're like water. You don't get to count us in your media consumption because, you know, it's informative. So, you know, it's not bad for you.
That's right. And that also includes tablets. And they now say that tablets are in almost 60% of homes. And there's been a big jump in media consumption on your tablet and on your phone. No surprise to anyone who's been watching video on their iPhone. Half of Americans have a subscription service like Amazon, Netflix, and Hulu. As far as I can tell, they are not including digital music services like Spotify, but I can't verify that for sure. But it looks like that doesn't include that, so that might be bumped up even a little bit more. Anyway, half of Americans have a subscription service like that, and that's the same percentage as have a DVR. So TV obviously is the big kahuna, the big one in the room, and you've got three main groups. You've got young people, who are people okay. under 24 and people up to 35. And you've got the middle-aged people, who are people 35 to 50. And then you've got older people, like me now apparently, people who are 50 and older. So what's going on? Who's watching the most TV?
I would imagine that it's probably 50-plus, right?
Exactly. Like they watch more than 5 hours of television a day. That's a lot of TV.
How much of that is Fox News and or MSNBC?
No, it's all CBS.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, you know, how much of it is just like on in the background?
So no surprise, the next group of people who watch a little bit less than me, in my mind, you always picture young people consuming a lot of TV, but it's just not true. Maybe if you're looking at 8 years old or seven, then maybe that's true. But when you get to people who are 35 to 50, they're watching a lot of TV, but not as much as 5 hours a day.
Yeah, you know, President Obama, there was a story in the New York Times about what his evenings are like. And he goes into the treaty room when he's at the White House and he does all this work and writes speeches and believe it or not, reads plays, apparently, reads the New York Times on and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal on his iPad. But one of the things that everybody commented on is that there is a television in the treaty room that is on almost all the time, sound down, but usually on ESPN or some sports.
There you go. So I guess
so I wonder how much of that is that counted? Is it counted, do you think?
You know, you consume it with the if you've got subtitles on, so I don't know. I think it would be. Or maybe he's using it in the background to keep track of when he wants to start paying attention. It would all depend on the person who's reporting themselves. Most of this is probably self-reported, which means Nielsen gave out a diary to someone like me. And at the end of the week or the end of the day, whenever I remembered, I would write down how much TV I watched, how much music I listened to, how often I was on my phone. So it's a hard thing to track.
Well, you know, speaking of Nielsen, actually, the Wall Street Journal has this story about how Nielsen is kind of unveiling, if you will, a streaming ratings for Orange is the New Black and Seinfeld. They're kind of making this known. At least they did in a presentation that the Wall Street Journal got a hold of. And they said that, what was it, like 6.7 million people watched the premiere episode of Orange is the New Black in the United States, which would be comparable to, say, the second most viewed cable drama on TV behind Game of Thrones.
Right, but none of that's true.
You don't think so?
No, none of the way they describe that or talk about that is true. First of all, Nielsen is not now tracking online shows. They've often been doing it for a while. They're being paid to do it, and the companies themselves know how many people are watching. What's happening is right. They were allowed to report on one or two specific shows that people were willing to share information with. So Netflix said, yes, you can tell people what you tracked on Orange is the New Black. However, it's not, you can't compare you're talking about the first 3 days of viewing option for Orange is the New Black. So the first episode in 3 days, which was watched by 6.7 million people. Okay, but that's that's not the second highest drama on cable TV, unless you're talking about just overnights. I mean, Game of Thrones is watched by 23 million people. Walking Dead, O.J. Simpson trial. I mean, there's a lot of shows that have more than 6.7.
And by the way, when you say O.J. Simpson trial, we're not talking about the trial itself. We're talking
they know,
people.
They know.
Yeah. Okay.
The people just versus O.J.
Right.
Yes. Right. So there are a lot of shows that get garner on cable more than 6 million viewers, but it's Live Plus 7, it's Live Plus 30, and that goes into Orange is the New Black. When do you say how many people have watched this show? On network TV, it stops at Live Plus 7, and really, once in a great moon, Live Plus 30. But Orange is the New Black, someone might not watch it for 6 months. They might sit down and watch the show. So Netflix says, hey, you cannot track our viewership the way you do with a network show where it comes and it goes. It's there always.
Yeah, I mean, Orange is the New Black, it's a show I watch. I knew that the fourth season had made its way onto Netflix, which is the only place you can see it. Haven't watched a single episode of the fourth season yet, but will.
Well,
probably
exactly.
In about
my
a month
point.
Or two. Yeah. No, I agree with that. But I do think there is a point where you can kind of say that a large majority of those that have or will watched it.
Well, we're not there yet. And we don't have those numbers,
I mean,
and we're not
going to
have it. So what we have is overnight numbers for two specific shows. That's all we have. So it's sort of a tiny, tiny glimpse into one momentary look at what's happening with TV shows that are available over the net. And
yeah,
what we know
I thought
is
it was kind
millions of
a...
people watched the new episode of Orange is the New Black the second they could. That's interesting. It's good. But it's nothing that you can compare to what Game of Thrones is doing or other cable shows are saying this is where it would rank. We don't know.
I would agree it's an apples and oranges comparison. What's nice is to get a little bit of a dipping the toe into this data water, if you will.
Right. They've got it. They won't share it.
Right. And it's nice to see even a little peek, even if it's not necessarily 100% accurate
and
right now.
I imagine a lot of the people watching Orange is the New Black are young people. But in fact, when we look at the Nielsen survey of consumption of TV and media overall, young people are really turning off of television. Young people 25 to 54 dropped an hour of media, of television watching, from 2014 to 2015. And when you're 24 and younger, the total amount of TV they watch a day is 2 hours less. It dropped 2 hours from 1 year to the next. That must be a blip or the way they're reporting it, or it could be just a bad survey. They didn't have enough young people in that mix. But the idea is that young people do not watch as much TV as we think.
Well, even myself, I am thinking of, you know, cutting the cord or at least canceling the cable subscription. It's like $150 a month. Of that, I would say about $100, $125 is the cable, not internet or anything like that. And I ask myself, really, what am I watching? I turn the television on so that I can get to the smart TV, all of the apps, the HBO Go, the Netflix, the Hulu. I have no interest necessarily in watching any of the TV shows except for maybe news or sports.
Let us know when you actually do cut the cord because you haven't done so yet. And then let us know how much your total bill is to access the shows that you want.
Yeah, well, I thought about that because, of course, like you, Michael, I always think, well, yeah, sure, you'll cut the cord and then you'll spend, $200 in subscription services. But the reality is there's only so much time in the day. And when I hear about a TV show that I would like to watch or a movie that I'd like to see or some series, it's usually on Netflix, on Amazon, which I would have anyway, thanks to Amazon Prime, or on Hulu. So those three right there is usually how I could get most of what I would want to see.
So do you have a music service?
I do. I have Spotify.
Right. And what we're talking about now is digital music streaming, which is another addition to your bill to consume media. And,
correct.
It's in a bit of turmoil, isn't it?
Yeah, although, and before we get into this, because I know we're about to get into to our music section here, in our music segment, where we're going to talk about all of this streaming media, music media. But I noticed over the weekend, I was kind of sorting through my playlist and realizing how long I've had Spotify and how many playlists there were. And just, I had to get rid of some and clean it up and I couldn't keep track of it all. But there is an album by Margot Price that I started listening to and I thought, you know what? I actually want to buy this album, which is, few and far between. Do I say that, maybe Arcade Fire, which I started listening to before streaming media came along. I'll do that with bands and artists that I want to support. This album, this artist, Margot Price, who's a kind of a country western singer, I thought, I'd like to support this. I'd like to support this artist. And it's like a political choice these days.
Well, it always was. You know, you want to support an act, you buy it at the show, that gets more money to them than if you buy it at a record store. You know, so supporting them in any way you can, buying a t-shirt, going to see them in concert, buying the album from them, you know, that's a great thing to do. And
well, and I wonder if
it's called
maybe
Midwest Farmer's Daughter, right? It came out in 2016 and you're liking it.
Yes, very, very good. And it's semi-traditional country western.
It's country. It's country music.
Yeah. And I'm not normally, you know, a big country western fan, but this is particularly good. The lyrics are they're quite good.
Yeah,
let's put it that way.
I gave it 3 stars out of 4. I thought it was a solid album.
Yeah. Now, so you're actually reviewing?
I just make a list of what I listen to and put a star rating.
Oh, okay. All right.
You can go to popsurfing.com and find it.
Oh, okay. Well, plug. What I was going to say is that if you're looking to support artists, maybe that's what Jay-Z and Kanye West and all of these artists who started Tidal, or they didn't start Tidal, but they kind of took Tidal over. Maybe that's what they were hoping for when they took Tidal over, is that, hey, if the artists benefit directly, maybe more consumers will come and hang out with us and pay us directly for their streaming service. Although in the end, it's right now it's 4.5 million, I think they have. 4.2 million paying subscribers is what they report.
Right, Tidal is not doing well. They took it over. They launched it to a lot of fanfare. They have some exclusive content, but not a lot of people are plopping down $20 just to get the occasional access to some music before others or a video that you can't see anywhere else. And now Apple is kicking the tires and they're thinking about buying Tidal. The question is why? Why would they want it?
Yeah, really the only reason that I can see is that they are just, Apple's always looking to secure better relationships with artists.
That would be news to artists.
Yeah, exactly. Especially Taylor Swift, who had to write a letter on Tumblr to get them to, treat her album fairly on their new Apple Music service. If you recall that from last year, Apple Music started, was launched last year, and this is a $10 per month streaming service. I believe $14, $15 if you want a family plan.
And they've got a lot of acts on board, and they've got a live radio show, and artists like Drake come on and they curate music or they talk and they feel like they've got a stake in it and can promote themselves successfully. But you're thinking they're going to spend billions of dollars to buy Tidal just to buy a little goodwill?
Well, I think they're also just kind of rolling up all of these services. They know they don't want Spotify because that would cost way too much money.
But why don't they just let it die?
I think that's really what they're going to do, is they're going to say, you know what? We can stand to break even on a music service like this for a long, long, long time. Whereas, you know, Spotify, Pandora, you guys can't because it's all you have. We have hardware. We have sales of other services.
No, the question is buying Tidal. Why not just let it die? Why spend money to buy it? Even if you're going to shut it down, like they kind of did with Beats, why not just let it die?
Well, as you've seen with a lot of these paid services, like Rhapsody, which I don't even know if that's still around.
No, it's gone.
It's gone, yeah. And Ardio, it's really hard to make a go of it. And a lot of these different services, they don't get to 4.2 million users. Whereas, you know what? When they bought Beats, I don't even know if it had 4.2 million. I think it had like something like 400,000 users when Apple bought Beats. So, you know, to have 4.2 million paid subscribers, they're buying the subscribers and they're buying basically one of the more important musical acts today, Jay-Z, Kanye West. These are people that... you get a big marketing bang for your buck with that kind of purchase.
But a lot of them are on Apple.
I know. That's what I don't understand. It's like they're on there. So why not just like let Tidal wither on the vine and see, you know, what happens after it goes away. I mean, as it is, Tidal has had 3 CEOs in the past year. Right. That's usually not a good sign.
Yeah. So they wouldn't be buying it because it's doing so well. They're buying it just to sort of snap up some attention, buy some goodwill, and maybe get some exclusivity for a little while.
Correct, yes.
Seems like a waste of money to me. And that's what Fortune magazine says about digital music in general. They say streaming digital music is a really bad standalone business. Radio is bankrupt. Deezer in Europe has delayed their IPO because their finances are shaky. Rhapsody has massive losses. Pandora is for sale. Tidal is for sale. Spotify can't make money and is complaining about Apple. YouTube is facing withering backlash from artists and labels. There are not a lot of good stories going around in digital streaming music.
Now, we should point out, by the way, that this whole Tidal story, which was in the Wall Street Journal, okay, is rumor, okay? It's people close to the matter.
Well, Tidal is a disaster, so I'm sure it is in play. Well, it's not much of a rumor. We all know it's a disaster.
Well, I'm pretty sure that Tidal themselves leaked this story to the Wall Street Journal, because I know it wouldn't be Apple. Why drive up the price on themselves? But I'm sure Tidal was like, hey, let's see who else is out there that might want to buy us. Leak this story. But, you know, you were talking about, you know, all of these music services. There's a bit of a controversy now between Apple and Spotify.
Well, not really. Spotify had a new version of its app, and Apple rejected it because they say, hey, when you're selling, when you have links to something you're going to sell offline, we get 30% of whatever you sell. So if you sell something for $10 and you link to it through the app, we get 30%. They've had that for years for every single... That's why a lot of people don't have apps on Apple anymore, because they don't want to pay them 30%, or they don't have the margins to afford it.
Right.
Spotify is now complaining about that, and Apple, with a pretty good leg to stand on, says, hey, we've had that for years. That's how we've done it. You don't like it, go somewhere else. Nobody's forcing you to launch an app on Apple.
Now, in this case, what they're saying is, hey, Apple, look, we're not asking you to, we're basically putting a link in our app to send people online to subscribe that way rather than an in-app purchase.
And that's what they said. That's what they said you can't do. Said you can't have a link.
Right. And the problem that Apple is going to have here is it really does look anti-competitive. It would be one thing if Apple Music didn't exist. OK, but they're both the retailer in this case, you know, the music seller with Apple Music, and they're the distributor with their app store. It's a bit of an issue.
But it's nothing new.
It's nothing new.
So Spotify says you singled us out because you don't want the competition. And Apple rightly says, we've had this rule, which a lot of people hate and think is bad, but we've had it in place for years. We didn't do it just to try to stop you. And we had it in place long before we launched Apple Music. And that is all true.
Right.
And I hate the rule. I think it's stupid. I think it's annoying. I wouldn't want it. That's why I don't, you know, I don't have an app for Bookfilter, because I wouldn't want to give them 30% of every kickback I get or compensation every time somebody buys a book from Amazon or Apple or Powell's through my website.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you, because you're basically only getting a small percentage of the
sale.
Right,
I'm getting 3-5% depending on what format and what book and what seller, and then they would get 30% of that. So if I got 50 cents for a $10 book, they would get, you know, 20 cents of that.
Right. Now, I think what will wind up happening, you know, by the way, Amazon doesn't have an app where you can go and purchase stuff on the Kindle app. You can't purchase anything on the Kindle app. You have to go to Amazon and purchase whatever book you want there, and then it will be sent to your Kindle app.
That's right.
So, and there's a reason for that. There's the 30% reason for that.
And they don't have links in the Kindle.
Correct. That's what I'm referring to.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm saying the point is, yeah, not just that you have to go there, but you can't even have a link to take you there in the Kindle.
Yeah. And Elizabeth Warren, who is now a congressman, but used to be
senator.
In charge. Sorry, you're right. I always thought a senator was a congressman, but you're right. It's Senator Elizabeth Warren. She has criticized Apple. She criticized Amazon and Google for anti-competitive practices. Now, people have been talking about this for years, yet nothing has been done.
That's right. So we'll have to see what happens. I think their complaint is a big whoop, but I think the rule itself is annoying and should go away in some way, shape, or form. They've got to loosen it up a little bit.
Ooh, well, if you think it's a big whoop, then what about some of the stories we're about to cover in Big Deal or Big Whoop? Not too many this week. It's a holiday week. Big Deal, Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story... After 12 years, TV personality Nancy Grace is leaving CNN's Headline News in October. Her legacy includes either a newfound focus on victims in cases that capture media attention, or it includes sensationalization and a complete disregard for journalistic standards like impartiality or legal standards like the presumption of innocence. Grace's ratings have fallen in recent years, and the once high-flying talent will resurface in a new venture, likely to include a significant online component. Hashtag good riddance. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop because her ratings have fallen so much. So it is not a death knell for Headline News. It's not a huge loss. She still is, I think, the top draw on that channel. So, you know, it's no big surprise. You have fading ratings. Maybe she thinks, like Glenn Beck, she can make more money online. Though I think in Glenn Beck, he sells gold. I don't know what she would sell online. Maybe pepper spray.
Ooh. The UN Human Rights Council passed a resolution this week denouncing governments that shut down internet access, essentially calling access to the web a fundamental right. Certain passages about the need for an open and free internet and the right of people to speak out online were fought bitterly by Russia and China and the like, but it passed anyway. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, I'm going to punt to you. What do you think?
I think it's a big whoop. It's completely unenforceable.
Well, actually, I think it's a big deal because I think the fact that they've set this benchmark and said this is a fundamental basic human right that we as a country and we as a world think that this is important and essential to freedom is a benchmark we're going to remember for a long time to come. And what could happen is if a country like China or Saudi Arabia tries to shut down the internet, especially in a time of crisis, maybe the UN steps in and says, you know what, we've got satellites in the sky. We're going to beam the internet to your people. You think you can shut it down? Well, you can't. So I think actually it's a big deal.
Talk about a U-turn. Last week, we reported that Matt LeBlanc would quit the UK auto enthusiast TV show Top Gear if his co-host Chris Evans didn't leave first. Apparently, they're not friends. You know, LeBlanc and Evans. Well, LeBlanc got his wish because Evans is leaving. And not a moment too soon. The once venerable TV phenomenon that was by some accounts the most popular TV show in the world has hit record lows in the ratings this season. Well, you won't be able to blame Evans for that now. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal in a way because it may give everybody pause before they mess with a big hit show. You know, I mean, you had Jeremy Clarkson attacking a producer. You had him saying scandalous, shocking, embarrassing things for years, and they did nothing until they finally felt they had to act. And now what's happened? They've screwed up a hugely profitable business. And in fact, this may make them say, oh, we're just going to put up with jerks in the future. You know, maybe this is going to cost someone their job. Maybe these people will say, well, you know, we thought we were doing the right thing, but it cost us money. Will they be willing to pay that price in the future? I'm not so sure.
Isn't it on the BBC? I don't think anybody's going to lose their job.
What do you mean? People don't get fired at the BBC? Of course they do. I'm just saying, by some accounts, but in a pure-headed business perspective, you just lost a massively financially profitable franchise. And it's not a franchise that you can control because they're going to go ahead and do the same thing online for another company. So the people that you get fired are going to recreate that somewhere else. Not only will you not have it, but somebody else is going to have it. And that's cost them a lot of money. And I approved of what they did at the time. But I think as business people, this may give them pause in the future to not be so high-minded. So I think it's an unfortunate lesson, but I think it's one that they might well learn.
Okay, putting aside who did what, it boils down to this. A court case has led to a restraining order on certain visual effects. To be specific, it's a facial motion capture technology called MOVA, M-O-V-A, and currently licensed exclusively by Digital Domain. MOVA has been employed in everything from Deadpool to Guardians of the Galaxy to The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. So while movies that have already used these effects are okay, those that are in production and those planning to use it soon will find it unavailable for the foreseeable future until the court case is resolved. Since we're talking about motion capture tech used by many films, this could be kind of a serious problem. Big deal or big whoop?
A big deal, right? I mean, what a nightmare for everyone involved.
Yeah, I mean, when you're doing visual effects, you need to plan things. You need to know which tools are available and which tools are not available. And especially when you're shooting. And to have this kind of thrown at you is kind of a pain in the neck.
Yeah, and this is a great story. You've got shady Chinese investors. You've got the FBI. You've got Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. It's going to make a great movie. They just have to wait for MOVA to be available before they can make it.
Oh, snap. Okay, that's actually pretty good. That was a pretty good connection there. Famed author Gay Talese has a new book out. It's a nonfiction look at Gerald Foose, a man who admits to purchasing a hotel just so he could spy on guests. Talese wrote about the man's life and his many years running the hotel. An excerpt appeared in The New Yorker, and the book comes out July 12th and is titled The Voyeur's Motel. Unfortunately, The Washington Post did a piece on the book, and looking into the claims of Foose, they discovered numerous discrepancies about when he owned the motel, when he sold it, when he had access to it, and so on. Told of this, Talese was shocked about the lies and said, "I'm not going to promote this book. How dare I promote it when its credibility is down the toilet?" Not so fast. Now Talese says he was upset and said things he didn't mean, according to his publisher. I mean, he didn't mean. They will make corrections in future editions, But the vast majority of the book is not in question, and Talese went to pains in the book to paint the man as unreliable in the first place. Big deal or big whoop?
So, yes. So, he is not good at interviews. I don't know why that is. I guess he's good at doing interviews, but he's not good at giving them. He gets himself in trouble when he shouldn't. And his later explanations are pretty believable. In this case, the vast majority of the book is not in question. The guy had diaries over the years of when he was spying on people. Other people who spied with him confirmed that he'd been doing this for years. So the main gist of the book does not seem to be in question. But he did lie to Gay Talese about when he sold it, who he sold it to, when he got it back, and things like that. But that's after most of the events in the book taking place. So it's a big mess. They're going to have a lot of corrections when they do a future book. But it's still an interesting tale.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And speaking of big messes, remember when, the Academy Award nominations were announced this year and for the second year in a row, it was, basically no actors or directors or writers of color that were nominated? Remember that? The Oscar So White controversy? Kind of a big mess. But after years of inaction, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences finally taken a significant step to redress the fact that its membership is old, white, and male. Now, you might be asking, how did they do this? They did this, if you hadn't heard already, by inviting a record number of people to join, with only half of them being white males. That's progress, I guess. Indeed, a new class of 683 people have been extended an invitation to go through the lengthy and unnecessarily laborious process of applying for membership. That group of nearly 700 people is almost half women, and 40% of them are people of color, although, as some pointed out, there's a lot of overlap there. Among the group is Idris Elba, Daniel Day-Kim, Frida Pinto, and Abbas Kiarostami, who I guess will not be joining since he passed away, and we'll talk about that later.
That's right. So they say there's an overlap, as if that's cheating. It's like, if you're counting the people of color, a black woman counts. If you're counting women, a black woman counts. So that's not cheating. That's just fact.
Okay, well, ultimately, in regards to, if we're going to stick with numbers for a second, then I guess it was, the Academy was 25% women, and that's been bumped up to 27%, and people of color was 8%. It's now 11%.
And those are significant changes, but basically my first reaction was, okay, that's nice. So that's a great step. Now do that every month for a year, and maybe you'll be getting somewhere.
Yeah, part of the issue here, and I think it's glaringly obvious when you look at who was invited. First of all, 683 people being invited all at once, okay? That's a 10% increase in your membership. This was supposed to be an exclusive club. This is like kind of a well-deserved honor, a lifetime achievement to get into it. And I'm not saying it isn't anymore. I'm saying that you've just kind of really swollen the membership significantly. So, that should kind of be taken
because
into consideration.
You should have.
Well, and that very well might be the case.
Too small for too many years.
And this was actually kind of one of the issues that we talked about with Travell Anderson when he was on the show. He's a writer for the Los Angeles Times, and the Los Angeles Times kind of suggested 100 names. According to Travell Anderson, they batted 360. About 36% of their list was actually invited to the Academy in this batch of 683 people. But one of the issues there in the LA Times list was, a lot of these people don't have big film credits or any film credits or a very short history in the film industry. And you're already inviting them into what is supposed to be something that takes, decades to get into, or at least some huge achievement to get into.
I disagree with that. I think the crossover between movies and TV is so big now that it's silly to look at someone who's very active and putting a lot of people to work and doing creative stuff and has made significant films that, you haven't made enough of them. I don't think the Academy membership and the idea of what the membership is and what it reflects changes over time, right? It's okay. Used to be you had to work for 30 years before you got in there. Well, no more. Now let's just say you have to be an important player. Used to be you were basically in the U.S. and part of the studio system. Now maybe it should more reflect the world. There's a lot of people internationally that are not on this list. Abbas Kiarostami, one of the great directors of all time, was just invited. you know, Hayao Miyazaki was just invited a few years ago. I mean, that's crazy. When you look at the number of directors, and just directors who should be in this list that aren't there, like the Dardens and the Tavianis and David Cronenberg and Bruno Dumont and Bong Joon-ho. I mean, there's so many directors. Christy Puyu. Is that how you say his name?
Yes.
You know, there are so many major, and you know what? A lot of those are white males, depending on how you define white. But that's okay. The Academy should be more international. That, I think, is an important diversity goal. It should have more women and people of color. You can't take a guy who works in the cheese industry and put him in the Academy. But people who are working in film and in the creative arts that belong in there should be in there. And there's a lot more people they can reach out to. Why don't you start with nominating everybody who's ever gotten an Oscar nomination? I don't understand it. You know, if you've gotten an Oscar nomination, you should be invited into the Academy, full stop. And you shouldn't have to jump through hoops either. You get a nomination,
well,
you deserve to be
in.
You get an automatic acceptance into the Academy.
Well, and I think certainly I always thought that if you won an Academy Award, you were pretty much in. But that wasn't the case at all, which always, that kind of shocked me when I found that out.
Even if you won, yeah, no, it's crazy.
Well, you know, so...
But I'll tell you what, they didn't just put in all the new people. They also added on some new rules because they're trying to fix the campaigning for the Oscars, which has gotten out of control, didn't they? They made two new rules. What are they?
Well, before we get to that, I would like to point out, you mentioned that, you know, gee, if they did this every month for a year, you might be able to fix it. I think part of the issue here is that if they did do that, they're already running out of people. And I pointed out to you when we spoke yesterday and before the show that Marielle Heller, who is a director I think is going to have a huge future, and I loved her first film, Diary of a Teenage Girl, but her first film is her only film to date, and yet she's now in the Academy as, you know, she wasn't nominated for an Oscar, and yet here she is as, you know, a member of the Academy.
As she should be.
What I would say.
And if you need more people, you take the other 400 on the LA Times list. They had 100 people listed, so they got 60 more people right there, right? 65 people on their list did make it. Guess what? Boom. And they'll all be non-white males. So, you know, there'll be people who are women or non-white. So you will add a pure 65 people to the Academy who will help bump up your diversity.
Right, but I guess what I'm saying is, how is it that you look at somebody who might, you know, you mentioned Abbas Kiarostami, okay, he's been a filmmaker for decades with a long, illustrious career of great films, and you're at the same time inviting somebody like Marielle Heller, who I really do like, so I'm not, this is not to knock her, I think she's going to be an even better director than she is today, and I think she's a phenomenal director and a phenomenal writer as based on her first film. But you kind of go, well, okay, how do you weight those two? How do you kind of compare those two?
This is,
by
not
the way,
this is not the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This is an active membership of people who are working in the film community. You do not have to work for 30 years to get into it. That's a lie. And it's not the way it is today, even if you thought it should be like that 50 years ago. So you know what? Times change. Rules change. Attitudes change. The AMPAS should not reflect people who've already done 30, 40 years of service. It's not the Hall of Fame. It is an active membership of people working in the film community. She belongs in there. She should be in there. And other people like her should be in there. Period.
So then you don't want me to compare Ice Cube and John Boyega?
They both deserve to be in. And I think that the comments about John Boyega were perfectly valid. He's worked overseas in films in a vibrant film community. You should have people from Bollywood in the Academy. Why not? You know, people in Bollywood and South Korea and China and Hong Kong, they should be. Because you know what? A lot of those directors come over here. We get John Woo. We get... you know, lots of talent that come over there, and people who act in Hollywood movies, who direct in Hollywood movies, who are world-class cinematographers that never come to the Hollywood studio system, or sometimes they do, but they're great talents. They would be a great recognition that the movie business is a worldwide business, and to recognize those other communities of talent, whether it's Nollywood or Bollywood or Hong Kong or whatever, I think today is appropriate.
I couldn't agree more. I completely concur, especially...
Well, you said you brought up the woman and said maybe she shouldn't be in it yet. She's only done one movie. She's great. She's talented. Do you think maybe 20 years from now she deserves to be in it once she has six more films in there?
Yeah, I think direct one more movie. Or would you like to talk about Michael Cimino, who we will be in a moment, who directed one or two good movies and then went off the rails? Yeah, right. So
and
there
then,
you go.
And
that's my point.
For 20 years. Was he in the Academy?
Yes, he was.
Well, there you go. So, but yeah, the
actually,
point is,
he wasn't. No, he wasn't. I don't believe he was.
Well, you can't make quality decisions that you will. It's not the Hall of Fame where you're saying they have done a career of Hall of Fame work. That's not what membership in the Academy is about. You have journeymen people who have a lot of credit. You know, it's not all the best of the best of the best. There are journeyman people who work in big Hollywood movies and have long, successful careers who may never get a nomination or a win in their life for any award. Do they deserve to be in the Academy? I would say yes.
Okay, well, you were also mentioning some new rules that the Academy has. One is no more concerts.
Right, so what does that mean? We're trying to limit the number of flashy, big events that people go to during the Oscar campaign season. And one thing they're saying is, all right, we're getting these lavish shows where people who perform music in a film go and they give a big concert. It's expensive, it's elaborate. And so they're saying, look, if there's an event where they're going to have a live performance of music from the film that they're promoting, you can't go. Just period, don't go. If they've got live performances going on, stay away. Because we've just decided that's too expensive and elaborate. Most movies could never afford to do that. It's just an indication of something that's way over the top. Don't go.
But how are you going to put that on the membership to kind of... I mean, I guess what they're saying is to the members, don't go when you're not allowed
easy.
To go.
It's clear. If there's a live performance, don't go.
But how would you know if there's going to be a live performance? I think they say that to the membership.
Paul McCartney is showing up to do a thing. It's not a surprise. And now the people putting them on know they can't have live performances. If they do, they cannot invite Academy members. And if they go, they could get in trouble. So everybody would be self-policing themselves. It's not a question of, you know, if you can't surprise them and have Springsteen give a two-hour show, that doesn't happen much. They want you to come and they tell you Springsteen's going to perform or there's going to be a symphony orchestra and we're going to do the score. Whatever it is, they can't do it.
Right. And I think that's really the rub there as far as enforcement goes is they're basically saying to their membership not to go, which means what they're really saying to the studios is don't throw these events where
right.
that happens.
Don't throw those events and the members will know. If they go and they're surprised, you know, that's obviously not their fault, but they'll learn and they'll get angry and people will report it and so on. The harder one is their other rule where they say, you know, try not to go to events where it's a really lavish meal. You know, don't go to something where it's really elaborate. You know what we mean. Well, we can't really be specific. But, you know, if you're going and it seems like it's too much, you know, don't. And if you do go, you could be suspended for a year. By the way, we don't really know what we're saying, but just don't do it.
Yeah, it's like we don't want you to do stuff, but we're not sure what stuff
we
don't
want
you to do.
How to define it or what to say. Like, do we determine the price of the buffet? Is it a sit-down meal versus a buffet? Buffets can be lavish with lobster. Is there lobster? Doesn't mean you got to walk out the door. It's a really bad, vague, silly thing. It's a noble... but dumb, misguided attempt to try and crack down on what's going on. This is not the way to do it. The concert thing is a clear rule. This other one is just so vague, it's ridiculous.
Well, do you think that, I mean, it seems very often over the past year or two, we've said, what is the Academy? Like, come on. Like, really? Like, it seems like a knee-jerk reaction or an ill-thought-out reaction to something.
Right, well, that's certainly what's going on here. They know the campaigns are out of control. They know they want to crack down. They couldn't come up with something good, and instead they did something dumb. That's almost unenforceable and certainly is confusing. Members don't even know what it means. I don't know what it means. How is anybody else going to know? So, yeah, they're not helping themselves.
Well, and just because you won an Academy Award doesn't mean you're not going to go on to direct, say, Heaven's Gate.
That's right. We have two big obituaries this week. Both are... pretty notable people. Michael Cimino, the director of The Deer Hunter, one of the big success stories of all time, certainly from the 70s, a Vietnam film, one of the first big Hollywood films to tackle Vietnam, and it was as big a hit as you could ask for. Massive critical acclaim, Oscar glory, and then he turned right around and made Heaven's Gate one of the biggest flops of all time, a movie that arguably brought down United Artists, and then a talent that people thought was going to have a big and glorious career went into a tailspin and made just a few films. Seven films from 1974 to 1996. That's it. When you look at Wikipedia, there are 21 films, I think, of uncompleted projects. So he had three times as many things that he tried to make as he actually did make. He made nothing for the last 20 years. So some would argue he was never that talented and was overrated, but whatever happened, it all came to naught.
Well, what I would say is if you look at the irony here is actually this book is now, as I'm seeing here, a number one bestseller right now on on Amazon, at least in the U.S. It's called Final Cut, Art, Money, and Ego in the Making of Heaven's Gate, the film that sank United Artists. It's by Stephen Bock, who was an executive at United Artists at the time, and it's all about the making of Heaven's Gate. And I guess the death of Michael Cimino has actually pumped up sales of this book, which it's kind of an ironic twist there.
He said the book is all lies, all lies.
Yeah. You know, I met him in Cannes in 2007 when I guess it was the 60th anniversary, and he directed a little piece of a film, a short for a film.
That was the last, I think, completed piece that he did.
Yeah, and it was a very strange conversation, and he was very awkward, and not to say that, maybe I was being, I don't know. It was a group of us sitting together, and we talked to him, and he walked away, and we're all like, what just happened? But
by the way, Final Cut is not a number one bestseller on Amazon. It is the number one bestseller in the ridiculous category of movie theory. It is not even a movie theory book. It's a business book, or it's a book about Hollywood. It's not movie theory whatsoever. But when you look at books, they have ridiculously narrow, bizarre, stupid categories. Asian children horse books. The number one bestseller in Asian children horse books.
So much like box office, where there's like 100 qualifiers, and it's like, okay, so it's a number one bestseller in books named Final Cut.
Amazon has gone crazy with all these narrow categories. But that's the death of Michael Cimino, a director I was never particularly fond of, but two at least interesting films. But a director I absolutely love also died this week. Abbas Kiarostami died at 76. He had a huge success at Cannes. Speaking of Cannes, he won the Palme d'Or in 97 for his masterpiece Taste of Cherry. And he's made a number of great films. Life and Nothing More, Through the Olive Trees, The Wind Will Carry Us, which I loved. He wrote and produced Jafar Panahi's film debut, The White Balloon. Just a terrific career. In fact, Jean-Luc Godard said, cinema begins with D.W. Griffith and ends with Abbas Kiarostami. That's how respected he is by other directors around the world.
Yeah, this is a guy who made Certified Copy with Juliette Binoche, which I think was in 2010, 2000. I can't remember when it was, but I do remember seeing this movie and thinking as I was watching, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. Is this movie ever going to end? And then when it finally was over, I thought, that was a masterpiece.
I actually didn't really care for it.
You know what? And that is an absolutely valid comment. We should mention that Kiarostami was from Iran. I don't know if we mentioned that.
Oh, yes, of course. Iranian. That's very notable. He helped put the Iranian cinema on the map. He stayed in the country even after the revolution, despite all the travails that caused for him. Towards the end, he was having to make almost guerrilla filmmaking in the country and then left the country to make some movies like Certified Copy.
Yes. I guess Makhmal Bhaff could also be credited for...
Absolutely. Yeah, he's not alone, but he, Kiarostami is just a master.
Yes. Now, we also have some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. I'll take a moment to read this one from Ralph Silva, which takes us to task you'll see. He writes, gentlemen, in your discussion of football/soccer, you came close, but no cigar. The name soccer was coined around 1863 in England. It issued from association football to associ football or ASSOC football to ASSOC, basically a soccer to soccer. The term football doesn't mean played with your feet so much as played on your feet, because common folk play sports on foot while the upper class play sports on horseback. And he provides a link, which we will place a link to in our show notes. One more thing. I heard Sperling use the word copywritten. Tisk tisk. And that's from Ralph Silva. I love our listeners. They are really smart, and they help us out with things like this. So even though it looks like it's taking us to task or giving us feedback that's critical, I love it.
And if other people want to contact us, what should they do?
Well, again, they can write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. They can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. As I mentioned, we have some show notes over at showbizsandbox.com, and that's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, that's showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, or Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free is where you can find us. And we do love it when you rate and review the show or subscribe to us in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. ShowbizSandbox.com is also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter, at ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, just search for Showbiz Sandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. He's mentioned a couple of them during the show. Michael, what is your website this week?
Knittingforever.com.
Knittingforever.com.
That promotes one of my many other podcasts.
Ah, okay. And you sure you don't want to do the whole, I can't even remember how we started, but it was somethingpolitical.com.
I'm right, you're wrong.
I'm right, you're wrong. That's what it was. That's actually a good title, and we should probably change the title of this show to that. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on any one of those websites, why not try michaelgiltz.com, popsurfing.com. You can head on over to Bookfilter, and of course, you can always find him on Huffington Post. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.